Okay, today is October 25th, 2008, and this is a third interview with Brian Proffitt for Heirs to a Fighting Tradition. And Bridget Burge is the interviewer, and we are upstairs in a little cubby that Brian has carved out, and it used to be attic that they converted to a space at Brian's house on Sycamore Street in Durham. And we're going to do our best to remember kind of where we left off, since I was slack and didn't listen to the last interview.
Either that or I'm like the most talkative person you've ever spoken with.
No, Cynthia Brown's the most. You're second. Good class. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, we're not done yet.
We're not done yet. That's
right. I can rival Cynthia. We'll see.
Alright. So let's start with you minored in film studies at State in 2001. Tell me why you chose film studies. It's pretty microbiology, because you were thinking about being a doctor.
Right.
And then film studies. What was that about?
Just for fun, really. I mean, I guess I always was really, really into watching movies, going to movies, really influenced by movies. So, in high school, I didn't have to work in the summers as long as I was doing, sports stuff. My parents were like, if that's what's important to you, then, you can do your workouts every day or go to camps or whatever. So I had a lot of time to myself in the summers, and I just, I used to know guys at the movie theater, so I'd just go see a movie, 4 days a week or something, just get in free, and just go watch the movie. So as long as I can remember, I've gone to movies. So then I was in college, and, I sort of made up my mind that I was just going to take stuff I liked. If that meant I took, 21 hours in a semester, that's fine, because the last six would just be stuff that I like to do. So I took an intro to film course just to see what it would be like, and dug it. It was like, I get to sit and watch movies and talk about them. Yeah, I'll do that, So I took, ended up taking 5 courses to be the minor. And you could do the direction of production or whatever, but the real strength at State was theory kind of stuff. And so I wasn't gonna be a filmmaker, so I just took the courses in theory kind of stuff. So I took a course in European directors, so Fellini and Bergman and Roberto Rossellini, and just kind of the influential European directors of the last mostly from the 50s and 60s, but a little bit since then, a little bit before then. And then, an African-American film course, which was pretty cool. And got to see stuff all the way back from the 30s, up until now. A film and spirituality course that I was actually just talking about at dinner last night. Because the guy who taught that course in the European Directors course, a guy named Joe Gomez, and he'd been teaching at State for forever. He sort of was the film department, and they've built people around him. And so Joe taught that course, and it was the last film in the course was this guy Lars von Trier, this Danish filmmaker, real influential, experimental filmmaker, made this film called Breaking the Waves with Emily Watson, who I have since totally fallen in love with. And I can just remember that the film classes, my classes were once a week at night, 6 to 10 or something like that. And I just remember walking out after watching Breaking the Waves, and the whole world looked like a different place. It was just the whole course kind of came together in this one film. It was oh shit, I get it. And everything looked different. And it was just I can remember the way the air felt and smelled when I walked outside. I was just wow, this is something different, And so I remember being really, really impacted by it. It's really funny that you asked this, because I was really just talking about this last night. The final in that class, we had an essay to write or something like that. And I can remember sitting down, and we had either 3 or 4 hours to work. Sat down, started writing. 3 or 4 hours later, I had written 16, 17 pages, and I was done. And it was the most proud of any work I'd ever done. And it was just I was able to take this whole course and kind of put it, in this kind of one piece of work. So it was, I had some really meaningful experiences in studying film. You know, and I felt like it gave me a pretty good lens at, like, you know, even just how to look at pop films and, you know, in addition to kind of art stuff or, you know, important, you know, historical stuff. So, you know, it was just fun. You know, I just tried to make college be, you know, I think I graduated with, like, 15 more classes than I needed to.
Big nerd.
Basically, you know, I mean, because I was done, like, I was basically done with my degree by the time I got to my fourth year. I had 14 hours left, you know, I had, like, which is basically, like, four classes in a lab or something like that. And so I was like, well, I could finish early and just take all the micro classes this one semester, or I could just take a whole bunch of shit I want to take. You know, how often are you going to be in college and have this level of time? I mean, at the time, you know, by then I was working almost full time. But, you know, I was still, you know, 21, 22, you know, and I was never going to be a full-time college student again, I didn't think. So, you know, I just thought, well, just take a bunch of stuff I like, you know. So I took all kinds of courses that I really got into and got a lot out of. And it, you know, it ended up ultimately serving me pretty well, because when I went back to school for my liberal studies degree and to get certified to teach, to become a social studies teacher, I had to have this many economics courses, this many sociology courses, this many history courses from these different places in the world. You know, these psychology courses, these, you know, anthropology. And so I'd already, you know, and since I was at the same institution, I could just say, well, let's look at my transcript, because it was only a year, you know, since I had left school. So I said, can I count this, 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 you know, so a lot of the stuff that I needed to take, I was already done with, because I had taken it as an undergrad. So it ended up, you know, kind of, quote, benefiting me in that way, in the traditional sense as well. But I just did it for fun, because I am a big nerd, so.
Say more about that moment, about breaking the waves. Like, what, how was it so different? What about the movie? What kinds of things that you learned in film class came together to...
I don't even know that I can really remember exactly what the moment was about, but I, you know, the film is, it's a tough film, you know, and I think if I looked at it now, I'd have a really difficult time with it, just because of the relationship of Emily Watson's character to her love in the film, and what she does, you know, because of that or whatever. But it's about, like, transcendent love, you know, and this, like, this spiritual connection between people that, you know, sometimes is not real pretty, you know. But the final shot, if memory serves, is you sort of, like, float up into the sky and you see this, like, bell ringing, like, in the heavens, you know. And it was just like, this is what love is. Love isn't just, like, some sentimental, you know, box of chocolates on, you know, Valentine's Day. It's like this, you know, this connection between people spiritually and, you know, people and their God, people in their, you know, sort of divineness. And I can just remember walking out and being like, damn, it's heavy stuff. It was really heavy stuff, you know. But it was like, you know, again, I think that I've never really been that incredibly moved by sculpture or painting or even really dance to a large part. You know, music has always been, you know, something that has moved me. But I think in encountering film in a lot of ways, and that experience to film as art was, you know, kind of my sort of way in to understanding art, you know, in a complicated way. So I think a lot of it was about that, just it's sort of about how art moves people, you know, and I haven't, you know, there are other forms of art that, you know, touch people in different ways that didn't necessarily impact me that much, but film did, and film, you know, continues to, but I just don't have that venue, you know, to look at a film as a serious work of art and break it down as a work of art in the same way that I did, particularly in Joe's classes, but in other film classes that I took over there.
Are there any political films or films that resonated for you politically that shaped you in some way or shifted your politics in some way?
Yeah.
What are a couple or a few that come to mind?
Well, I mean, it's Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, You know, I mean, I think I've mentioned this in my previous, you know, accounts that I was really impacted early by any conversation about race. And I can remember my my cousin, you know, who was like the one who turned me on to a lot of hip hop and a lot of different things when I'd see him, you know, once every year or two. And he had this script, he had like in book form of Do the Right Thing. And I remember reading it long before I saw the film. And he was just really impacted by these characters who were from this world that I'd never, you know, seen and what it was that they were talking about. So, you know, when I finally saw the film, I know that it had, you know, a big, big impact on me. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's hard because, you know, you don't really know. It's hard to remember, like, these moments when, like, different, you know, kind of transitions happened. You know, a film like John Sayles' Matewan, you know, talking about the coal miners' struggles in West Virginia back in, like, the, I guess it was the 20s and the 30s. You know, it was important. You know, seeing a film like, I can't remember the director, but a film that was made about Patrice Lumumba called Lumumba, you know, was really impactful because you get to see, sort of see the impact of the U.S. on the rest of the world. You know, and it's countless documentaries about people's lives, you know, about situations that people, you know, went through. I remember seeing I have a tape of it. It's maybe like on PBS or something like that, of called Freedom on My Mind, which was about the Freedom Summer in 64 with the SNCC folks. And, you know, just seeing Fannie Lou Hamer and just watching these kids, you know, who probably by the time I saw the film were significantly younger than me, you know, putting their lives on the line like that. You know, there's a film that came out a few years ago called The Weather Underground, which is about the weather folks, and, you know, kind of encouraged me. I'm feeling daily guilt about this because I had always thought that I should be writing letters with folks that were in prison, you know, just sort of as a way of, you know, support and building relationships. And so finally, after I saw that, I was like, okay, I have to do this. And so I started writing letters with David Gilbert after seeing him in the film, because it was just, he just shined in the film. You know, he'd been in prison for probably 20 years by the time the film was made, and he just has this glow about him and this warmth about him, and it's just like, damn, you know. And, you know, the stuff that the weather was doing, you know, it's sort of easy to look back and be sort of romantic about and say, oh, you know, if I was then, I might have done this. And, you know, it's strategically, I don't think it was necessarily the right direction, but you have to put yourself in this moment and say, shit, I don't know. You know, the whole world is turning upside down. And, you know, as a white kid, it's just like, what the hell do you do, you know, in this moment? And, you know, to watch these people who walked away from their families, walked away from their lives, risked everything, you know, and was it strategically the right move? I don't think so. But I, you know, again, who knows what you would do when you're in that moment? So I started writing letters with David after that, and I'm feeling guilty because it's been about 4 or 5 months or more since I've written them. But, you know, that had an impact on me, and that, you know, that was a new sort of relationship that came into my life because of, you know, the film, which is, you know, that's not something that always happens when you look at a movie. It's like, oh, and you start a friendship because of the movie, you know? So, yeah, you know, I'm sure there have been lots and lots more. But, you know, for a while I was really into Spike Lee, and he was doing a lot for me. So, yeah.
So what do you think about right now how Bill Ayers is being played in the media, and say who he is, and kind of your thoughts on how the weather is being talked about these days?
No, I think it's desperately sad and pathetic. You know, when he first came up, like, you know, a year and a half or however long ago that was, you know, for me it really felt like this was the Clintons, who are like the most cynical human beings on the planet, really kind of grasping at straws during the the primary campaign. And, you know, so Bill Ayers was one of the folks who in the late 60s was a leader in the Students for Democratic Society, and was one of the people when there was a split, you know, at the SDS convention in 1969 on which direction, you know, folks should take. And, you know, Ayers was with the split that won, you know, and kind of took the organization in this direction of, you know, really kind of, you know, they sort of left the campuses, went into white working class communities and decided that they were going to, you know, organize on the ground and fight, you know, and literally fight the police to say, you know, if the Vietnamese are fighting, if the Black Panthers are fighting, you know, if Africans are fighting, you know, these national liberation struggles, then white people need to be fighting to take some of the pressure off. And so after, you know, a little while, they weren't having a lot of luck with that, and decided that they would abandon that strategy and that they would go underground as a small, you know, collective of folks, organize themselves in cells all around the country, and, you know, begin a campaign of armed resistance that at first was sort of ambiguous about whether or not it might target people. And then there was a famous accident. It was an explosion at a townhouse in Greenwich Village, where the bomb that they were building was being planned to actually target people. A group of, I think it was naval officers at a ball. And so after some three of their folks got killed in that accident, they decided that they were gonna stick to targeting places and not people. And so, you know, over about the next 7, 8, 9 years, they waged this campaign where anytime, you know, there were these, you know, so when Nixon revealed that the U.S. had been bombing Cambodia, or that the U.S. was going to invade Cambodia, you know, they targeted specific places. You know, when I think it was when Shell Oil was, you know, doing some really nasty stuff with respect to the Portuguese colonies in Africa and Mozambique and Angola, you know, they targeted Shell Oil. When the police or the FBI would, you know, go after some Black Panthers, they'd, you know, they'd blow up a facility that related to that. After the Attica uprising, you know, they put a bomb in New York State correctional offices. And so, you know, at the end of the 70s, you know, as the war was over and folks on the left really kind of lost their direction, you know, all these different organizations that had started to try to build communist parties had kind of fallen apart and, you know, devolved in this sectarian awfulness of attacking each other and just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, and the weather was kind of marginal. And, you know, there was a brief period where they had sort of an above ground, it's called the Prairie Fire Organizing Committee, auxiliary that was kind of working with them. But the weather has sort of lost its direction, you know, because the primary thing that it had been involved in was, you know, support for national liberation struggles, you know, by, you know, oppressed peoples all over the world. But, you know, by the time things were happening in the 70s, it was like, you know, China had taken a very different direction politically. Most of the national liberation struggles in Africa were over. They had won. You know, the Vietnamese had won. And so this thing that kind of bound folks together, and even the Black Liberation Movement in the U.S. was decimated. You know, so you had some folks that went underground as the Black Liberation Army, and some folks, you know, just kind of going in lots of different directions because the Panthers, who had been, you know, kind of this force that was providing direction for folks, had been, you know, assassinated, drugged, kidnapped, imprisoned, you know, until the organization was basically dead. You know, the Black Liberation Movement was so scattered that the weather didn't really have much to relate to. So folks started coming up in the mid to late 70s. And the interesting thing about it is that, you know, that because the way they had done the investigations for most of the 70s, most of the stuff that they had on the weather was illegal and couldn't be used in court. And whereas that didn't really stop them when it was the Black Panthers or the American Indian movement, you know, the courts for some reason, you know, respected that. And so most of the folks that came up in the late 70s and early 80s, nothing could happen to them legally. And so that was the situation with Bill Ayers, his partner, Bernadine Dorn. Mark Rudd was another guy who came up. Then nothing could really happen to the majority of the folks. Number of the folks thought that coming up was a sellout and that it was an abandonment of the commitment to national liberation movements and continue to stay underground and work in support of folks, particularly the Black Liberation Army, which was sort of a, you know, real loose, almost kind of anarchist, you know, cell structure of folks that were kind of doing independent actions. And so David ended up working with a BLA cell that robbed a Brinks security truck. And in the course of the getaway, a couple of police officers were killed. And David's been in prison since the early 80s. Most of the folks that went on to work in kind of BLA support work and other, you know, support of other kind of underground stuff did go to prison. Kathy Boudin, who was David's partner, was in prison until the early part of this decade. A woman named Marilyn Buck was in prison for a really long time. A number of different folks that kind of continued ended up going to prison for their work, while most of the folks who came up during the 70s, you know, have gone on and kind of had these sort of legit lives. And so Bill teaches at the University of Chicago in the School of Education. Bernadine teaches at Northwestern School of Law, and, you know, has done a lot of stuff with, like, children's defense kind of law and stuff like that. So, you know, Bill's kind of been this legit figure in Chicago for a long time. You know, I know folks that know him. And, you know, so it's not surprising that anybody who would be doing social justice work in Chicago would be working with Bill Ayers, you know, because he's been around for a really long time and has a lot of relationships. So it just, you know, it just feels absurd that you know, someone would say he's a, you know, a terrorist and all of that. You know, and again, there's this vacuum of historical knowledge about what the weather was, you know. And so there's never anything. I mean, even somebody said something the other day on the news about, you know, the Weather Underground, who, you know, did all this and this and this and may have been responsible for the killing of such and such. And it was, you know, and I was just sitting and looking at the news and saying, this is totally inaccurate. The Weather is not responsible for the death of anyone except for three of their own folks. So I think it just sort of points out this gulf in historical knowledge from what was going on in the 60s and 70s and where we are now, that Bill Ayers' name could, you know, come up like this. But it, you know, it doesn't really seem like it seems to me like people publicly have read it like it is, you know, which is just this, like, grasping at straws. But it's also, you know, for these at least fringe elements that, you know, have a validated space in the mainstream, you know, it has provided some space, you know, for, you know, when Palin is, you know, talking about, you know, who Obama is at her rallies, you know, people, you know, yelling out terrorist and, you know, kill him and all this kind of stuff, which is pretty frightening. And I think the Bill Ayers stuff connects to that. You know, fortunately for Obama, you know, they've not connected him to, you know, Assata Shakur or, you know, Fred Hampton Jr. or one of these, you know, they've not connected him to a Black revolutionary from the time period, because I think that would have opened up a whole new area, you know. But I mean, there hasn't, you know, I've never seen a picture of Bill Ayers' face, you know, in the middle of any of this stuff. So there's also this sort of like, well, who is Bill Ayers? So I wonder if folks are reading, you know, Bill Ayers as this Black revolutionary figure or whatever, you know. Now, granted, I don't watch the television a whole lot, so they could have a lot of pictures of him out there. But, you know, I think that the repercussions of this discussion would be a little different had it been somebody connected to the Panthers, for example, or the Black Liberation Army. So then there's also been this connection back to, you know, Obama as Muslim as terrorist, you know, kind of thing that's come up a lot. And, you know, that I've been telling folks is deep, that the most progressive and what I thought principled position that anybody has taken in this whole like 2-year saga around race, religion, etc., was Colin Powell, you know, who earlier on in the week said what Obama should have said a year ago, you know, when this thing about Obama being a Muslim coming up. And Colin Powell said, you know, no, he's not, but B, it doesn't matter, you know, because Muslim kids need to feel like they could go to the White House too. And, you know, he kind of couched it in this sort of like nationalist, you know, there's this photo of this woman, you know, mourning at her son's or her husband's grave, you know, at Arlington, and it has a, you know, Muslim, you know, crescent, you know, on the grave, and he died, you know, fighting for freedom for America too or something. But it was just like this moment where like Colin Powell is like the voice of reason, which was just like, whoa, how have we gotten here? Like, how really, how have we gotten here that this dude is taking the best position? But, you know, I think in the middle of this chaos, you know, him offering that was really helpful. You know, I don't know to what extent it really, you know, has held. But I also think, you know, it's like the Bill Ayers thing has been this sort of like, on one hand, connecting to this race-based fear, you know, and on the other hand, connecting to, you know, I've not heard it a whole lot that, you know, Bill Ayers was a communist, you know, but that's this other thing that's coming up right now, is that Obama is somehow a socialist, which is, you know, again, laughable. But, you know, there's also this other direction that the Bill Ayers thing could be taking, which is like, you know, if people were smart and people understood who Bill Ayers actually was, they could have said, wow, he was a revolutionary communist and Obama's hanging out with him, so maybe he really is a socialist. But people aren't smart enough, you know, like the historical knowledge isn't even there to do that, you know. And so I think that actually, if they were going to use Bill Ayers, in my mind, that would be the direction I would go. But they don't seem to be, you know, slick enough to put that together. So I don't know. I think it's just silly. It's just silly and it's desperate and they're done, you know. And the only way it can happen for them now is like just out and out theft, which, you know, they've proven quite capable of doing on the last two, you know, occasions. But yeah, I don't know. It just feels done.
How do you personally feel about Barack Obama?
It was interesting. I was thinking about this like and wondering if it was going to come up in our conversation, because I almost, we were going to go vote today. We're gonna go vote early, which I still will do, but I think now I will have voted in, or had the opportunity to. I'm trying to remember if I even voted in 2004. I think that I did, but 2004 and 2000, I guess, are the only two elections in which I had an opportunity to vote. And I remember writing, you know, for the campus paper in 2000. And saying that it was a choice between the, you know, the lesser of two weasels, you know, and just being like, this is ridiculous, and I gotta pick Al Gore, you know. And then feeling even less inspired in 2004 by this clown. I mean, John Kerry was just like, what are you offering me here? So I think that, you know, to the extent to which there has been a legitimately potentially successful political candidate in my lifetime that has run for president, right? Which is, you know, that's a lot of like subsets of people. You know, I'm most excited about this. You know, I started off this process as a bit of a hater. You know, I was just like, you know, this motherfucker doesn't talk about anything useful, and, you know, and I still kind of feel the same way. But I also, you know, I've been challenged by some folks, and folks just saying, look, dude, this is somebody running for the president. Like, what are you expecting? You know, like, really, what are you looking for? It's 2008. We are in the period of, like, 40 years of entrenched, just getting the crap kicked out of us, you know. I don't know what you're looking for right now, but this is probably the best we're going to get, you know. And, you know, sort of putting it in that context, I think has been really helpful, you know, and just looking at, like, you know, typically it's like, well, you know, it's like this guy isn't the most, this guy is awful, 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 but he's not as awful, awful, awful as the other guy. This guy's like awful, awful, you know, it's like two awfuls, you know. And so I feel like, huh, well, he's kind of good then, you know. So I think, you know, just in terms of like healthcare stuff,
Israel and foreign policy just hurts. Just hurts to hear him talk.
Man. And it's deep because back in Chicago, like, he was once an ally of the Palestinian folks and the community there, you know. And so it's like, damn. So it just shows, like, the strength that the pro-Israeli folks have in terms of shaping the discourse of the U.S., which is deep because it's not a big group of folks, you know, but they wield, you know, they wield some clout. And so that's frightening. And just all this stuff about we're in the wrong war and we need to shift all this stuff to Afghanistan. It's just like, man, will you stop talking? You're giving me a headache. So that's all really hard. You know, and the stuff about, I think, he would get beat on it if he tried it, but merit-based pay for teachers and, you know, some of the stuff he says, I'm just like, God, you're awful. Right? He's like a black dude who might get elected president of the goddamn United States of America. You know, like, it is 2008 and we are, like, you know, in like the 232nd year of the existence of the United States, and it's a black dude that's gonna be our president, you know. And I think I've been most struck by it listening to the radio in the last couple of days, because it's been talking about, there was some stuff on the radio today about these union workers going around campaigning for Obama, right? And you know, and when you think about, like, you know, the sort of stereotypical union worker in the United States, right? It's like a white dude, you know, from like rural Pennsylvania or Ohio or West Virginia, you know, who's like, you know, wears his, you know, his pants and his hat, you know, and he's going off to work. And it's like, these dudes are like going door to door and like knocking on doors and saying, like, you got to vote for this guy, and talking to other white folks, you know, about why to support a black dude. And it's just like, wow, this has opened the door, you know. And so it's really interesting because, like, so much of my life is spent immersed in this black school where I teach, where it's sort of like, it's sort of a given, it's a granted, you know. And so, you know, the discussions have actually been really powerful because the kids have tempered a lot of their perspectives. You know, it's like, well, he's probably not going to be able to do this, and maybe he won't really support us. So it's been cool, because at first I was kind of concerned that it'd be this like Obama as savior kind of thing that I was going to have to work with. But the kids seem to be taking a pretty good position on it. But the way that this has opened the door for white working class folk to be talking about race, I think has been really powerful. And just sort of the lines to get drawn, and for some people to say, like, I am not voting for a black dude, and have to say that out loud, you know, and see how other people relate to it. And, you know, somebody on the news was talking today about, like, you know, they were having a conversation with somebody on their doorstep, like, five times, five different angles. And then finally it was like, okay, could you just not vote then for president? Could you just vote for the other ones and don't vote for president? And then that might actually be a viable option, because people know that McCain's a piece of shit, but they can't stomach voting for a black dude. And so, and they're open about it. And so somebody says, okay, great, just do this then. You know, and so this is a new conversation. You know, Richard Trumka from the Steelworkers, like, you know, making, like, videos and talking to his workers and saying, the only reason you would not vote for Obama is because he's black. You know, like, white organized labor taking this position is, man, it's kind of mind-boggling.
He says, let me offer some other things to consider.
Yeah, it's just, it's deep. It's really, really deep. You know, and again, it's hard, right, being in Durham and teaching at a black school, because I don't really get this perspective. You know, I'm not really interacting in a whole lot of white spaces, you know, in Durham, in the world very frequently. So I don't get much insight into how those conversations are playing out, but it's really powerful. You know, it's really kind of important. You know, I just, you know, having conversations with my mother, I think, voted for the first time that I can remember in 2004, because she was just like, couldn't deal with Bush. And it was just like, really? Like, you know, where is this coming from? And I don't think I've asked her explicitly, but she has offered several times about like how this McCain Palin thing is ridiculous. You know, so I feel like my mom's like gonna vote for Barack Obama, you know, and it's like, that's pretty cool, you know. It's pretty cool. So yeah, you know, it's very tempered, you know, by a whole bunch of like, this dude's an imperialist. This dude is the candidate of Wall Street. I mean, he made that $700 billion, $800 billion, who knows how many trillions of dollars is actually gonna end up. I mean, he made that happen, you know, by getting on the phone and making that thing work. But he's also like kind of interesting at the same time for a lot of different reasons.
Have you read Dreams from My Father?
No.
I just finished it last night. You should read it.
Yeah. Okay.
It's deep. It's just, it's, he,
that's the first one?
That's the first one.
Okay. Okay. Yeah,
that's the first one. So it's a whole lot about racial identity and finding his past and going to, back to Kenya for the first time. And a big chunk of the book on Chicago and organizing lessons. It's deep.
Huh. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'll look at it.
Yeah,
I'll
want to hear what you think about it. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's gonna be, you know, and just people like, you know, people having conversations. You know, I've got friends. You know, I have a friend who is like, I haven't voted since 1980, when I, you know, needed to vote against Reagan. You know, who are like anti-electoral in like every possible way, being like, it was a spiritual experience for her to go and vote for this black dude, you know? And, you know, it's, so I'm trying to like, it's, you know, I think that while I can understand the historical significance of that and be moved by that, like, I also don't have the experience of being a black person in this country and being like, oh shit, like the president is a black dude, you know? And so I think that's the other thing that has really, you know, kind of chilled out a lot of my criticism. Is, you know, I've got really smart folks around me who are like, you know, just strategic in every way possible, being like, I watched the acceptance speech and like turned off my critical everything just because I wanted to soak in hearing this black dude talk about becoming the president and knowing that he's going to, you know, and just, and this being like, I mean, this is like Bill Fletcher, you know, who like is this mentor to like, you know, so many people that I know, and this like coldly calculated political creature, and Bill just being like, I turned it off and I just soaked in this brother giving this speech, you know? And so I think that, you know, that's the other thing that I'm trying to sort of sit with, and, you know, just listen to how my kids talk about it, and what it means for them, you know, is a lot. You know, is a lot. And again, as a white dude, I think that there's a lot about that I can't know and can't experience, but I'm sort of allowing myself the space to be moved by it, you know, in a way that is sort of helping me turn off a little bit of the, you know, kind of hater stuff I was coming with at first. So
I'm also really struck by how much music and artist and Hollywood and real multi-ethnic, you know, multinational, there's some beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
And that doesn't even touch on just how fun, like satire, I think, is brilliant, political satire. So the
Tina Fey is Colbert, killing Tina, me.
Oh my
Tina
God.
Fey is killing me.
I mean, it's some of the most brilliant stuff. And I think they're talking like them having impact like Chevy Chase and Ford. Like, really, people still blaming him for Ford. Because, so I think
yeah.
Political satire, they really have some political influence.
Yeah. You know?
And so, yeah, it's Tina Fey is brilliant stuff.
Doing it right now. She's unbelievable. And it's, you know, I also was looking, we were talking, I'm doing a unit on the three branches of, you know, the government in my civics class this last week. And was looking at the presidency one day, and, you know, brought in, you know, Nas did this song called Black President. And we looked at the video and talked about it, you know, and he's sort of taking this, like, you know, you, like, civil rights generation of folks who don't want this young brother to succeed and all this. He's being like, you know, fuck you, we're talking, we're stepping up, you know, and it's just like, you know, kind of playing, like, looking at this generation gap a bit. Yeah, there's some powerful, you know, like, Big Boy from Outkast doing a song, which is basically just an Obama commercial, you know, is the video. You know, and so there's been a lot out there. And I think if anything that's really exciting about this campaign is the public consciousness. I mean, people are fucking talking about politics, man. You know, Saturday Night Live is relevant for the first time in, like, who knows, 10 years, 15 years, you know, that show hasn't really mattered, you know, and now it's like, it's Saturday Night Live again, you know, because people want to go see what the hell Tina Fey is not even on the show anymore, you know.
They're on Thursday nights too.
Yeah, so it's like the level of discourse, you know, that has evolved around this campaign, you know, which I think after the election of 2000, you know, people were paying attention. You know, and in 2004, people were paying attention, but not like this. This is something else. You know, I think that the Hillary Clinton piece is, you know, is a piece of that, is very exciting, and the Sarah Palin piece is a piece of it that's really, you know, been stimulating. But I mean, ultimately, it goes back to this dude, you know, this black dude that is gonna win the presidency, you know, and have his two black children and his black wife in that White House with him, you know, which is. You know, it's a lot.
Yeah.
So I almost had the experience of voting today and being able to talk about that, but it, you know, it just didn't come together. So part of me kind of wants to wait, you know, if I wasn't so, like, just aware that North Carolina actually, you know, the other thing is as cool is that I've never voted in a way that mattered for the presidency. You know, Bush was gone when in 2000. Bush was gone when in 2004. And so.
And North Carolina was late and going to be red anyway.
So. Yeah, you know, and so voting in the primary when it actually mattered was pretty cool. You know, and voting in this presidential election, you know, it's like, man, like when I put my little arrow next to Barack Obama, like, it matters because he could win North Carolina. Or he could lose, you know. So it's like my vote actually means something, you know. And filling in Kay Hagan to get Elizabeth Dole's awful ass out of there is gonna be cool, you know. And so it's like, you know, for the first time in a minute, you know, and it's coming at this time period when I've been pushed really hard by people around me, politically, to recognize the centrality of electoral politics. To winning some power in this place, you know, and I'm moving. I don't know if it's maturity or if it's just that the tactical, you know, sort of relationship to electoral politics is becoming clearer to me, and I think clearer to a lot of folks on the left nationally, particularly in the wake of this last election. You know, I could see myself, you know, the some of the stuff that I'm working with folks in Durham here and talking about trying to build in Durham is about building something that could look like, you know, something like a party, you know, or an apparatus like that, you know, that would engage in local struggles around electoral stuff, possibly at some point could offer its own candidates, you know, and having that be part of a national movement to do the same thing. You know, and hook up forces, you know, folks that can work with, you know, the sort of left end of the Democratic Party, you know, and actually work to shift elections and become relevant, you know, in a way that the left is, like, really, really not relevant, you know, in the United States right now, because elections is where the majority of people in the United States interact with politics, you know. So I think the longer we stay on the sidelines, the less relevant we become. And it's like, so all of this is kind of going on in my head at the same time when I'm voting for the first time in a way that feels important to me, you know. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
Are you with a specific organization that's thinking about this electoral work locally, or is it?
Well, I mean, I think nationally, you know, my connection to Freedom Road, you know, there's a lot of conversations about, you know, starting to, because people have the experience, you know, people on the left have this experience of having been involved in the Rainbow Coalition in 84 and 88. The Rainbow Coalition, which spanned, you know, a good chunk of the 80s and was, you know, this powerful place for organized labor, for the anti-apartheid movement, for the nuclear freeze stuff, for the Central American support work, for like regular folks on the left side of the Democratic Party to come together and have something that for a brief period had autonomy from the Democratic Party, worked in conjunction with the Democratic Party, but had autonomy in some ways, some small ways, from the Democratic Party. And then, you know, got wrapped up in a cult of personality around Jesse Jackson and was co-opted by the Democratic Party. But folks in the left in the 80s built that thing. Revolutionaries, communists in the 80s worked really, really hard to help to put together this force called the Rainbow Coalition that, you know, I mean, Jesse Jackson won the primary in South Carolina, you know, in one of the elections. It's like, put together something meaningful, you know. And so people are starting to have this people around the country are starting to have this conversation again around like, well, what would a neo rainbow be, you know? What would it take to put together something that, you know, wasn't immediately focused on winning a national level campaign like the Greens or something like that, you know, but could start to integrate building new mass organizations on the ground in local places, and then hooking those mass organizations up with other people to see how you can shift votes. You know, so you've got in this election, you got in Northern Virginia, which is really, really critical right now. I mean, somebody was calling it a socialist enclave or something like that in the news recently. I mean, in Northern Virginia, you know, there's an organization called Tenants and Workers United that has built this, has been the kind of the centerpiece of building this 501c4 electoral, like, get out the vote apparatus, that is reaching like 10,000 folks or more. The Miami Workers Center, which is doing some of the most innovative work in the country right now in terms of their organizing in low income communities and with workers, particularly like in the service sectors. Miami Workers Center got a grant. It's putting like 25 canvassers on the ground doing get out the vote work, touching 10,000 folks in a couple of weeks. And so they're going to be going out encouraging people to vote and getting information that they'll go back and use in their organizing, you know. And so these two sets of folks that are just, you know, I think doing some of the best work in the country, period, are now looking at this electoral work in a really meaningful way. And so, you know, I think it would be dumb to not be looking at them, who are like the smartest people out there, you know, as far as I can tell, who are really investing in electoral work and saying, well, you know, there's something here. You know, so there's these conversations among folks that are saying like, well, how do we replicate stuff like this? How do we take these models and maybe begin to have, you know, an impact? I mean, this guy Max Elbaum out in the Bay, who, you know, is a scholar of the, you know, kind of 68 generation, the, you know, the folks that were kind of came of age and like a Maoist, you know, kind of political trend. And Max has been influential in lots of ways. He writes for War Times, which has been this, you know, newspaper that's been around since the, I guess, war in Iraq started, or maybe even prior to that. You know, every time I talk to Max, he just says, you know, we need to build a, you know, neo-rainbow, new, you know, we need to build an electoral apparatus. We need to have an impact on the election in 2012. You know, and he's just like, that's it. I don't, if you're talking about anything other than that, you're wasting your time, you know. And he's a pretty smart dude, you know. And so I think that with some of the folks locally, people who we've worked with, you know, over the years, and lots of different capacities from Hip Hop Against Racist War, you know, 6, 7, however long ago years that was, to Ubuntu and Men Against Rape Culture, you know, and some of the work we're doing around there. Like, we're trying to get a set of folks to get together and do what we call social investigation, you know, kind of map out Durham, you know, and do some study, you know, of some people who approach work in this kind of way, and make a map of Durham, you know, and say, here's where the big employers are, you know, here's who the real estate developers are, here's what the plan is for downtown, here's how many people own a car versus how many people ride the bus, you know, here's where Black people live, here's where Latino people live, you know, what are the school districts like, what are the electoral districts, and kind of get this good, comprehensive, strategic picture of Durham. And at the end of it, say, okay, now, the capacity that we have as 10, 15, 20 people to go to develop some new kind of organizing work, or hook up different kinds of organizing work that we may be engaged in, to say, let's build an organization or organizations that have membership, like working class membership, you know, develop leadership, do campaign work, maybe one day do electoral kind of work out of this kind of, you know, operation. How do we do that, you know, so that we actually have an impact on the political landscape in Durham, instead of just being like anti and participating in building this statewide coalition or this thing? Like, how do we shift the conversation in Durham so that working class people have control over their lives? You know, and electoral politics is certainly going to play a role in that in the long term, you know, probably not anytime soon. Though, you know, Ray thinks we can get somebody elected in, you know, 2 years, you know, and Durham, he may be right, you know. And so at some point, you know, hopefully if we can build, you know, some power, and some legitimate organization around some of this stuff, we could have that fight, and we can say, well, is it better to get somebody elected when we don't have the mass base to really move yet? Because then they could start making it easier to do organizing, and, you know, from the top can kind of have an impact, or do we wait until we have a big mass base to try to run somebody, or do we ever run somebody, or do we just push people, you know, on the questions, you know? And that's some of the experience, you know, the folks at Tenants and Workers United in Northern Virginia, you know, I was talking to one of their organizers the other day, and he was saying, look, we're not interested in running folks, you know, any of our people for campaigns, but we've shifted the dialogue. There's things that we couldn't talk about publicly 4 or 5 years ago, and now are on the table, you know, because of the work that they've done. So, you know, so that's really exciting, you know, and I want to be involved in the stuff that gets us out of the margins, you know, that gets us out of like the protest vote, you know, or 4 people standing on a sign, standing on a corner holding up signs, you know. Not to say that those things aren't important, you know, but I really want to be trying to build real organization, you know, on the ground that is not an organization that's just folks who already get it, you know, but like really interacting in the day-to-day political dialogue of a city. You know, the school board wants to do this. They can't do that unless they have our support, you know. You know, I think that's a conversation that we've kind of moved away from because we've been getting our asses kicked for so long, and it's just like, well, what if we could win? You know, like what does power mean? You know, and we were having this conversation with some folks. We were kind of having a meeting about this the other night, and you know, one of the guys involved, he was like, man, he was like, you know, that the bailout plan got crushed the first time it got offered, and in 2 or 3 days, they flipped the vote of dozens of people. He was like, I want to know how much power it takes to flip votes of a dozen people in a week on an $800 billion question. He's like, I want to know what that power is, you know? And I think, you know, we shy away from this question of power because it's delicate, you know? It's like, well, there's power over or power through, you know? But it's like, until I think we begin to enter the conversation with real organization and in and focused on different things, then we just keep protesting, you know. And I'm not saying that we're not gonna keep protesting, but you know, but how do we win? You know, how do we, you know, I think I was really struck by, there's a guy, Davey D, who's a DJ and a political, you know, sort of commentator out in the Bay, writing about Rosa Clemente being chosen as Cynthia McKinney's vice presidential, you know, candidate. And he was really excited about it, you know, because here's this, you know, Afro-Puerto Rican, you know, being chosen by this African-American woman, you know, to run for, you know, the Green Party, you know, I suppose could be considered, you know, a big deal, you know. It's a big deal that Cynthia McKinney was picked, you know, for this, particularly, you know, with her role in the Democratic Party previously. And so he's writing about Rosa Clemente being picked, and he said something about, I don't have any illusions that we're going to win, but it's enough to just put some issues on the table, or something like that. And I just sort of, I read it and I just winced, and I just thought, fuck, like, is that enough? Is that enough? And is that respecting what we're doing to say that it's enough to not think about winning? You know, and to say, well, you know, it's enough that we, you know, held up our signs and yelled and, you know, hollered some questions from the margin. We were that one dude in like a room full of 1,000 people who was like screaming stuff from the back, you know, and people like look at us and they go, you know, and then they keep kind of going about their business. I don't think that's respectful. You know, people are dying. All over the world, people are dying. Right here, people are dying, and I think that we need to begin to think about winning, you know. And that's not gonna be clean or pure, you know. It's sort of like people say, like, hold your nose and vote, you know. It's like, hold your nose and build a movement, you know, and say, like, man, politics is an ugly game, and you know, it's not gonna just be like clean and pure and we can just take, you know, the exact position we want to every time, but if we're gonna matter, you know, I think that we're gonna have to start doing some different things. So, yeah, who knows? Maybe this is me like becoming conservative or something. But I don't
caught on tape.
I know, right? No.
The death.
No.
Youthful resistance.
But I just think that I want something new. And I think that people deserve something new.
You know? What is your vision of a liberated world? We did this one.
I think so.
We did this one. We'll do it again. We'll see if there's anything.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I thought there's a on this album that Common made back in like 2000 called like Water for Chocolate. He did a song about Assata Shakur, and at the end of it, he actually interviews her. I think like probably over the phone or something like that. And she says, it's funny. She says, freedom. You asking me about freedom? You're asking me about freedom. And then she says, you know, I don't know what freedom is. You know, I know what it isn't, you know? And so, you know, so it's hard to even imagine, you know, what that world looks like. But I think that it looks like a world where people who do the work make the decisions about the work that they do, you know, where like we don't have to, people don't have to work till they're 65 and then die 2 years later, you know, or worry about their like pension disappearing, you know what I mean? Like folk right now are like 70 something years old and worrying if they're gonna have to go back to work. Like, what the hell is that? Like, that is no kind of world that I want to live in. And that's here in the United States, where people even have the option of retiring. You know, people all over the world don't even get to consider, you know, stopping working. You know, no, you don't even live that long. You just die. And even here in the U.S., I mean, on some reservations, like, life expectancy is 40-something years old for men. You know, and it's just like, that's not something I want to be a part of. You know, I want to be a part of a place where, like, kids get to, like, explore the world and not have to worry, you know, and not, we don't have to like limit them because they might not be safe, you know, where we get to like read beautiful books and see beautiful movies, and you know, where our work means something. You know, it's not just like fucking making money for somebody else, you know, and where our schools are like these places for exploration and meeting the needs, you know, of the future. I was invited by my principal to participate as our school's delegation at the Durham Public Schools high school reform meeting. It meets like 4 times a year or something like that. And, you know, I asked the superintendent, we got this like 5-minute question and answer period with the superintendent. I was like, well, how often am I going to get this chance? Let me just ask. You know, and I said, what's the plan for like the ecological crisis? Like, what's the plan? Is there a plan? If so, where can we find it? And if not, can we have one? You know? And he was like, yeah, there isn't one. You know, they were counting days that they had fuel left, you know, in the recent period, you know, where there was some shortages in North Carolina. They were counting days they had fuel left for the buses, you know. And it's like, there's no plan for food. There's no plan for, like, energy efficiency. There's no plan for fuel. You know, like, that's not a world that I want to live in. Like, a world that I want to live in says, damn, there's this big challenge ahead of us. Like, how are we gonna fix it? You know what I mean? Like, have kids in schools working on like solar technology, you know, and growing gardens in the back so that the school lunch can be like safe, you know, and we know there's gonna be food, and that the food might actually be nutritious, you know, and that the kids actually know where the food comes from because they grow it themselves, you know, and like where we can say, like, you know, we're not so stuck in this like reactionary discourse where we can say, like, man, how do we fix stuff? You know, how do we recognize like the challenges, you know? And people in the United States can realize, like, I am part of a planet where there are other people, you know, and what I do here impacts what happens to other people, and what other people do in other places impacts what I do here, you know? And I think this sort of, like, you know, globalization has become this like evil word or whatever, but like globalization is a fact, you know. Like, globalization is like a globalization where we get to like interact with each other and meet each other and know each other and make solutions with each other, you know. And, you know, people aren't put into boxes because they are men or because they're women or because they're not really feeling like they're either of those things. Or, you know, because they come from a certain place. You know, like, I've just been really heartbroken lately by looking at my kids and just being like, fuck, somebody rolled the dice and you lost, and that's it. That's it. They're 17, 18 years old, and they're a good portion of them are not going to make it out of their 20s. Either alive or from the other side of bars. Period. You know, I've asked two of my guys lately how many black dudes they know that are 30 that have never been to prison and are alive. One of them said one, the other one said two. You know, and it's just like, that is not something I want to be a part of. That is not a planet that I want to be a part of. And these kids didn't do anything wrong. They didn't sin. You know, they just were born, and that's it. You know, that is it. That is their lives. You know, and you know, there's no Horatio Alger. There's no pulling themselves up out of that. It's just, that's it. You know, that's their choices. You know, and so they can either hustle, you know, while they're here to, like, not be worrying about money every second of the day, but be worrying about getting killed every second of the day or getting arrested every second of the day. Or they can worry about money, worrying about starving, worrying about the lights getting turned out every day. You know, that's your choice. You either, like, hustle, which is going to kill you or put you in jail, or you, like, work in a $4 an hour job, you know, frying up chicken or french fries for somebody, and they shut your lights out, you know, at the end of the month, every month, and your phone is never turned on. That's not a fucking choice. That is not a choice. I want people to have choice. You know, people would get to decide who they want to be, you know? And if you want to be a weirdo or a nerd or like a dancer or whatever, that you get to do that, you know, because that's who you are and we value who you are, you know. It's like, that's not where we're at right now. So I know a whole lot more about what we don't have, you know. I can't imagine what it would look like, you know, for all of us to just get to be us, you know. Who knows? And for there not to be any, like, West Bank or Gaza, you know? Like, what the hell? Like, what would that look like? I don't know. Just, I want to know. I'd like to find out, you know? So, I mean, that's why I get up in the morning, because I want to know. But it's, sometimes it's hard. You know, I got folks that are like, they can't read about what's going on with the ecology anymore. Because if they do, they won't get out of bed. You know? Because it's just like, why? Why does it matter? It doesn't matter what we do, because there's not going to be clean air. And we're going to be underwater, and all the bees are going to be dead. And half the plants are going to be dead, so what the fuck? Why get up every day? You know? And it's just like, that's not okay. That's not okay. And, you know, sometimes I come back to my school, you know, and I leave right when school is over, and I come home and I fall asleep, because it's just like, it just feels so big, you know? It just feels so big. So I want to not feel like that. I want to not have my friends be like, I can't get out of bed today because it doesn't matter what I do, because there won't be water in 50 years. You know? That sucks. That sucks, you know? For my kids to go through what they go through, you know, just breaks my fucking heart. Kids, you know, talking about, well, you know, I asked them one day, you know, talk about a decision that they regretted or something they wish they could change. You know, this girl's like, well, I wish I wouldn't have flipped out on people when my father was murdered. I wish I would have handled that better. She's 16 years old. She might be 15. You know? And she's talking about wishing that she would have handled it better when her father was murdered? You gotta be kidding me. You know? And you just want to die when you hear stuff like that. You know? So it's just like, I don't want that. Nobody should get murdered. You know? No, but that, you know, that's, can we just say that? Can we just say that a liberated world looks like nobody gets murdered? How about that? Can we just start there? You know, kids don't have their fathers taken away from them because they're murdered. Over some bullshit, I'm sure. That's my vision for a liberated world, Bridget. My kids' fathers don't get murdered. You know? Just fucking terrible.
And pause just for a second.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me about, maybe you did say when you met Rebecca, but tell me about her, like describe what you love about her, what you like about her most. What's she like? What do you love about her?
It's hard to encapsulate. She's complicated, man. She is somebody who, you know, without like really getting into it, like should not be here, you know, like, and it's, you know, it's I think about some of my kids in the same way. It's somebody who, like, the way that the world, you know, it's like Audre Lorde's poem, you know, it's like for those who were never meant to survive. You know, like, this is where you find life, you know? And so like, I marvel sometimes at, like, what she can do and how she can grow and how she can laugh and smile. And, you know, I think it's just, she's figured out or is constantly searching to figure out, like, what it is that she can do and what it is that's good for her, you know? And she knows that she likes, she gets comfort from spaces that are pretty and orderly, you know? And so it's like the aesthetic, you know, is directed towards, like, how do I make my space pretty and orderly, you know? Or, like, You know, when we first met, she was watching Finding Nemo like every day, you know, because it was just like watching Finding Nemo, like, just makes you feel good, you know. And she'd walk around the house, you know, singing, just keep swimming, you know. And it's just like, man, this person is just unbelievable. You know, and it's, you know, she's not got a whole lot of people around her, you know, and is, you know, very intentional about that, because it takes a lot of energy to have a whole lot of people around you, you know. And that's hard for me, because I like to have lots of people around me pretty constantly, but it's also like really helped me kind of come in, you know, and sort of learn how to take care of myself a little bit, you know. I think that if I were left to my own devices, I would just go until I fell apart. And so, you know, she's really good at knowing like how to take care of herself, which is pretty inspiring and pretty pretty helpful a lot of the time. And she's hilarious, you know, and just really, really funny, and can just talk shit with like the best of them, which, you know, I need. And is really, you know, just stunningly sort of smart, you know. Like, she didn't go to class very much at all her whole like first year of medical school, and did just as well as everybody else did. This is medical school, you know. Like, she just has the capacity to like do stuff without putting in, you know, as much effort as other people need to, that it's just like, damn, like really, how smart are you? It's kind of absurd sometimes to think about, like, you know, what other people do and what she does and how she ends up doing as well as everybody else. So she's really into the kids, you know, the babies. So she's gonna be a pediatrician. And you know, when she comes back from working with kids at the hospital, it's like a different, you know, like the schoolwork and the studying and the going to classes has just been sort of drudgery for her. But when she gets to actually do it, you know, it's like everybody, like, she's got nurses who are like, I wanna work with you when you become a doctor, you know. And like, you know, doctors who have this like manner with kids that just doesn't get them anywhere, and she'll just walk right in and just say like, oh, you know, and approach it in this way, and the kid gets them, you know, gives them what they want, you know. So she's special. She's just really special. And, you know, gets me in ways that I didn't get me, you know, and holds parts of me up that I didn't even know were there, or that if I did, I wasn't holding them up, you know. And just sort of like adoration, you know, for these things. They just sort of like, yeah, that is cool. That is cool that I'm that, you know, that I don't think I would have got to on my own, you know. You know, I'm not known for my humility. But it's funny. I mean, a lot of that is just kind of play, you know? And so I feel like, you know, there's, you know, just like with anybody else, there's lots of insecurities, and there's lots of, you know, I just, you know, I kind of play with this kind of ego thing. You know, and certainly I've been afforded the space to feel really good about myself in ways that I've not had to struggle with like other people have. But, you know, it's also like, I don't walk around sort of like really, really thinking, you know, that I'm all of that. But like, you know, since I've met her, it's like, no, like, you really are that, you know, you really are like amazing in these ways. And it's like, I'm just like, really? And she's like, yeah, you know, you should know that. And it's just cool to kind of, you know, I think that I've gotten, you know, a lot of my friends would say that I didn't need this, but, you know, there's like sort of a self-esteem boost, you know, but just because she's just made me feel really good about who I am, you know. And yeah, she's just great. She's great. You know, she loves taking care of, like, she loves being able to take care of things, you know. So like, we have this dog that's like our child, you know, and just like, she just loves like being able to take care of Bean, you know. And, you know, there have been conversations about us having kids that, you know, could materialize in the next couple of years, and it's just like, I can't even imagine what she is going to be like with a child that is hers, you know. It's just gonna be really, really like shocking, like, the intensity of love. You know, and I know that that's kind of, like, how, like, the thing with mothers and their kids anyway, you know? But there's, like, there's this whole other level of the way in which if there's something she's responsible for, what she does with that thing, you know? And so I'm just, you know, there's no way I can prepare for what that's going to look like. But it's, you know, it's exciting to think about. So, you know, and, like, a year ago this time, like, it didn't look like we were going to be together. And she just is, and not, this isn't directly offered, like, at the end of that sentence, because we both had some stuff to work on, but, like, she works on herself unrelentingly, you know. If there's something that she wants to figure out, it's, like, you get self-help books, you talk to, you know, professionals, you go to this place, you do, you know what I mean? It's just, like, you just do, you know, everything, you know. And it's like, you know, whereas something's wrong with the toilet, like, I'll just be like, well, let's just call somebody who knows toilets, you know. She'll, like, get on the internet for, like, an hour and then, like, teach herself how to do something, and I'm just like, why, you know? But it's just like, because I, you know, this is what I do, you know. And so it's really cool because she just, you know, is always into, you know, growing in new ways. So it's a lot of fun.
How long have you been together now?
It'll be 5 years this coming New Year's, since we met.
Is there one really sweet memory that, like, pops to mind? Some sweet memory with you and her?
Well, there's lots. I think, we first started dating. I had student taught at Clayton High, the semester before we met. And so when we first started dating, we went to a basketball game at Clayton and the next semester, because I just wanted to see some of my kids or whatever. And they had this contest at halftime to, like, you know, go shoot a free throw and win, like, $100 or something like that, you know. And you know, I was turning and talking to one of my students, and all of a sudden there she is, like, running down, like, the bleachers to, like, go and shoot a basket and maybe win. And it's just, you know, I remember being struck at the time, like, damn, this chick is, like, crazy, you know, like, she's just this, you know, just really spontaneous, just whatever. But what's really interesting about that is, like, in hindsight, like, that's not who she is, you know. But, like, to be able to get that much outside of, like, who she is to, like, participate in something that was meaningful for me, it's a lot. So yeah, that's pretty cool. And I just, you know, there's all these sweet things from when you know, sort of first meet. But, you know, I think even just, like, I mean, most of the time she refers to me, she calls me Angel, you know. And it's just like, and it's not just, like, this term that just gets thrown on the end of a sentence. It's like, she really is, like, putting something into it, you know. And so it's just like, wow, like, this, you know. Yeah, I keep going back to the words a lot, and I don't really know. I'm kind of into words, so the fact that I can't come up with words for it is, you know, significant.
That'll make you want to be your best, someone who looks at you and believes and knows that you're a real angel.
Yeah.
that'll make you grow right there. Someone love you into the best of yourself.
Yeah, it's something else. It's something else.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about? I know we can't remember the last couple times, but
we talked about everything.
We talked about music, movies, we talked about books you like.
Sure,
organizations you've been in.
I don't know what there is left. You talked about everything under the sun.
That's great.
I hate whoever has to be the person who listens to all this and types it up, because they're just ramblings about
they're not all rambling.
Kinds of this and that.
Good stuff. So in your justice work, what sustains and nurtures you?
People. You know, it's like, the goal here is to, like, retain some level of humanity in a whole world that is designed to, like, just destroy our humanity right now. You know, it's like capitalism literally turns people into commodities, you know, and turns all of life into commodities. And despite that, people laugh and people talk shit and people cry with each other and people go for walks and, you know, people do yoga and, you know, people just, you know, people cook, you know, people just do these things and people just make it, you know. You know, I got kids that, you know, I consider my, you know, my teaching to be part of, you know, my work. I got kids who shouldn't be here, you know, and who go through just the foulest shit every single day. And they get up and come to my class and try to learn about the Constitution. You know, and it's just like, what, are you kidding me? I would have folded up and quit. I'd be laying in a corner, you know, rocking myself back and forth in some hospital somewhere. And they're trying to learn the Constitution. You know, and it's just like, damn, it's just really blown away by people's capacity to, one, survive, and then two, to still smile and to still love and to still dance. And, you know, and it's just like, man, I mean, that's what gets you through. You know, it's like, if my fucking kids are, you know, going through this and can smile, you know, and can crack jokes on each other and can dance and can, you know, it's just like, nah, man, I can do it. I can do whatever because they're doing that. You know what I mean? Like, you know, again, it's like, if people in Gaza who have been locked onto a plot of land where there are no resources can survive, you know, and fight back, there's nothing I can't do. You know, there's nothing I can't do. And so, you know, I think just kind of like holding, just kind of being among people and seeing what people have the capacity to do is just sort of like, well, yeah, we win. In the end, we can win. We can fix this. You know, we broke it. You know, what's the Dick Cheney, you know, metaphor about the pottery barn, you know? You know, it's like, we broke this thing. We broke it. And we can fix it. You know, we can. We have to. That's, you know, that's our task, you know? And it's like the, you know, Fanon quote, you know, each generation, you know, has to find, you know, what its purpose is, what its mission is, and either betray it, you know, or do it, make it happen. And that's not exactly what Fanon said, I'm sure, but, you know, it's like, we have to do it, you know. I'm driven by, like, it's hard, you know, like, Rebecca and I go back and forth, like, sometimes, like, when she touches the awfulness of the world, it's like she has to retreat, you know, from it and has to like sort of insulate herself from it. I have to work when I see it, you know. And, you know, I've been, I don't know if it's a blessing or if it's a curse, but I've been blessed with this capacity to you know, kind of endlessly put in time and put in work and put in energy. And it's just like, if I was given that, then I need to do something with it, you know. So, you know, if there's stuff that's broken, then you gotta just fix it. You know, you just gotta go and go and go and go until it's fixed. You know, and part of that is like this kind of Catholic, you know, gotta be like Jesus, you know, thing. Which, you know, I'm sure has impacted me in some ways, whether I, you know, like it or not. You know, but it's like the old, I mean, it's biblical, right? But the old, like, communist, like, slogan, you know, to each according to his need, you know, from each according to his ability. I have a lot of capacity, you know. I have received every level of privilege that one could have. You know, right down to having like a stable and loving and affirming household, you know, and I better do something with that. You know, I do not have long on this place, and I better do something with that. Because otherwise, what the hell am I doing? You know, like living for me? Like living just a life that's like about like making my life better? That's not what we're here for. You know, that's not how I became who I became. You know, I became who I became because people lived for me. Because I got, you know, parents who, you know, put shit aside to help me grow. You know, I have teachers and professors who have committed their lives to, like, making better people. I got friends and family who would do anything for me and have, you know, held me down when you know, it was rough. I got people around me who should have just folded up and quit on themselves, much less like giving any energy to me. You know, I got kids who, like I said, you know, should not be here, but let somebody say something bad about me, you know, and they wouldn't have it, you know? And so it's like none of those people live lives for themselves, you know? None of them. They all live lives for, like, you know, the people around them and the world around them. So what am I gonna do? You know, how's it gonna look for me to say, oh, well, you know, let me just, you know, work so I can get my 40-inch, you know, flat screen plasma TV, which, you know, I'll get, you know, if Obama loses and we gotta go to the Circuit City. But, you know, like, how's that gonna look? Like, that just doesn't make any sense. It's not right. That's not what we're here for. Despite everything that capitalism tells us, that is not what we are here for. We're here for each other. You know, that's why we're here. And, you know, I got no other choice. You know, that's like if that's God, you know, like if that's God, then that's the purpose that I've been given. And I can't quit, you know. And plus, I'm like obsessive, you know. Like, I stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning working on a PowerPoint from my class the next day, cause I gotta look for 45 minutes for this one picture that's in my head, that I know is gonna be the one that's gonna make it make sense, or is gonna be the right one. And I'm just so proud when I project that image, and, you know, it's like, dude, let go. But it, you know, I just don't work like that. So, I mean, what keeps me engaged is just us. You know, I can't watch a Hollywood movie and somebody make a sacrifice for somebody else. I can't watch Finding Nemo without tearing up. You know, like when all the fish are in the net, you know, and Nemo goes back into the net because he knows how they can get out. He says, we just gotta just swim down, you know? And like his dad's saying, no, I'm not gonna lose you. And he says, I have to do this. I know how to do this, you know? And his dad says, okay. And he believes, I mean, right now I'm getting a chill, you know what I mean? This is like a fucking cartoon. You know, but I cannot see someone sacrificing for somebody else and not just be, like, moved by it. You know, even just, you know, just the smallest gestures that people make for each other is, like, that's how we affirm our existence in the middle of, like, this just fucking awful place that we have constructed. You know, and so it's, like, that stuff gets me through, man. You know, that stuff gets me through. Like, that's why you do it. You do it because people taught you to do it, and you gotta teach other people how to do it, and that's why we're here. So I'm just doing what everybody else is doing, you know. I'm just doing it a little differently.
It's a really beautiful way to end. Thank you, Brian Prophet, for being part of this project.
Thank you for letting me be a part of it. I don't know what I did to deserve it, but it's been fun.
You cry at Nemo, you white man, and you deserve
some accolades. Yeah, well, I'm hoping that part doesn't end up in the transcript.
All right.
I'll lose some of my street cred, like I have any.